Last week we were looking at the something nothing theology of verse 3. A person thinks he's something when he's nothing, he's insane. And the issue, the contextual issue of the something nothing issue is the question of whether a person is something because he can do something significant that will qualify him to be superior to his fellow believers. And Paul says, no, you're nothing. You can't do anything that'll qualify you to be superior to your brethren. In the first place, that's true simply because Galatians 2:20 is true. We don't live the life we live. If there's any good that comes out of these bodies, it is coming out because God has given us the Spirit of Jesus dwelling in our bodies to compensate for the weakness of our spirits. And it is true that those productions out of our bodies is related to our confidence in the promises He's made, because we are a part of that new creation. Our souls and His Spirit constitute a new creation, and out of that combination of our souls and His Spirit, our bodies are motivated to do good things. But because it's His Spirit that's doing that, we can't claim any credit for it. And given the fact that we can't take credit for it, we can obviously never use anything that's produced out of our bodies to make us feel superior to somebody whose life has been sidetracked by the temptation in verses 1 and 2. The issue of being trapped by some temptation. So that's basically where we were. And what Paul is trying to do is to buttress verse 1, looking to yourself lest you be tempted. Because the temptation will be to think you're something when you're nothing. And that will complicate your relationship with the person that you're trying to restore, because he or she will pick up on that attitude of superiority if it's there. Now, in verse 2, he said that we were to bear one another's burdens, but in verse 4, he says, let each one examine his own work, and then he'll have reason for boasting in regard to himself alone and not in regard to another, for each one shall bear his own burden. So this is where we're going this evening, verse 4. This whole idea of examining our own works so that we'll have a basis for boasting in regard to ourselves alone and not in regard to somebody else's either accomplishments or failures. And obviously failures is the key word there, because if we're going to be boasting in regard to ourselves, obviously that means that we can't compare ourselves to somebody else and use them as a basis for lifting ourselves up. And that would automatically mean that either they failed or the things that they're accomplishing aren't nearly as significant as the things we are. That's that comparison business. But anyway, what we want to do this evening is to examine this thing about Paul making the point that fallen creatures have an absolute inability to warrant admiration, legitimate admiration, and then turn right around in verse 4 and talk about having a basis for boasting. So, what's going on here? I think that what we'll do this evening is look at this issue of what he means when he says, let each one examine his own work, and then he'll have boasting. You notice the reason for is in italics in the New American Standard. I don't know what. A reason for is just an interpretive phrase. He will have boasting. He will have a basis for boasting, a reason for boasting, in regard to himself and not in regard to somebody else. And the overall impact of that has to come off of verse 3, so that what he's saying in verse 4 is, if you are intent on seeing yourself as something, at least stick to your own works and not your fellow believers. At least that's the minimum that he could be saying, because it's clear then verse 3 that somebody's wanting to look at themselves as somebody, something. I'm really something. And given that desire, he says, verse 4, if you're going to push that desire, at least stick to your own doings and forget about comparing yourself to somebody else. The question, of course, is what he's really dealing with, and so that's where we want to go. This issue of boasting in verse 4, examine his own work, and then he'll have kalkema, a basis for boasting. He'll have a rejoicing or a boasting in regard to himself alone. What is that? What does it mean to have a basis for boasting or to have a basis for rejoicing? I think the King James translates that rejoicing, but that's not the normal word for rejoicing in the New Testament. It's the normal word for something that's more profound than rejoicing. Anybody that enjoys sports and picks teams and wants one team to win and not the other knows exactly what this kalkema is, or kalkesis. It's that feeling you have when the team you want to win does something that looks like it might make it possible. It's that inner sense of exultation that causes you to get up out of your chair and yell and make an idiot out of yourself. You know, because this is really what you want. This is something that you really want. And when you get it, or it looks like you're going to get it, there's this emotional repercussion in you. It's called kalkesis or kalkema. It's an exulting. It's an emotion. It's a feeling of high joy. What Paul is dealing with in saying this, that you can have this boasting or this exaltation or this high level of joy by examining the quality of your own works, he's saying that that's a way to get there. But there is a deeper question, and that's the question of why do you want to be there? Why do people want to exult when typically the exaltation is, in the majority uses in the New Testament, it's a bad thing. And the reason it's a bad thing is because the motivation's bad. Not itself a bad thing, because Paul is actually going to say here in chapter 6, verse 14, may it never be that I should exult except in the cross. So there is a basis, a legitimate basis for this exulting. But what is it that causes the exulting based on the cross? That is related to the issues of verses 3 and 4. Thinking you're something when you're nothing. Having a basis for exulting because you've examined your own works. What's really going on there? The key is this. There are two fundamental ways that people get to the feeling of exulting, and they're diametrically opposite. One of them is that if you can demonstrate that you're superior, that your works are superior, your skills are superior, your accomplishments are superior, you can exult over the people that you're superior to. And all of us recognize that that's not healthy. That's an ungodly thing. But the point is, we're trying to accomplish what? We're trying to make ourselves believe that we're superior, that we're valuable, that we're extremely valuable, that we're God's gift to somebody. That kind of thing. Well, what does the cross have to say about that? Well, the cross says, you are very valuable. You're extremely valuable. Because God would not have sent His Son to die for you if you weren't enormously valuable. Because the price He paid is beyond, it's off the scale. None of us can even begin to grasp the depth of the price of Calvary in relation to the Father and the Son. And because that is set forth in the Scriptures as the evident proof of God's love for us, that means that we are valuable, and that's what's supposed to cause us to be exulting. So, you can exult on two different bases. You can exult because you think you're valuable because of what you can accomplish. And Paul says, frankly, you're insane if that's the way you're operating. Or, you can have this same sense of exulting because God has said to you, I love you. And if we understand what he means when he says that, it should create this high joy thing, this exulting. But there's nothing ungodly about that. There's nothing ungodly about being held in high esteem by somebody else, as long as you're not trying to claim the credit for getting them to think that way about you. There's nothing wrong with being held in high esteem by somebody. The wrong is when you want that so bad and you try to make it happen by being superior. And then they hold. But you know, that is totally self-destructive. Everybody that I've ever known who has demonstrated a desire to be held in high esteem by others is not held in high esteem by others. They act and behave in such a way that everybody whispers behind back, well, what an idiot, you know. They'll put up with it face to face because we're polite people. But behind their back, we don't consider them valuable. We don't even want to really be around them. So the very effort of trying to be important on the basis of self-promotion things is self-destructive. It just makes people despise us and think we're not worth anything. But on the other hand, if God loves us, okay, it's off the chart. So when you look at this word about exulting, and you ask, well, why is exulting important in this context? Well, obviously, it's because it is a part of human makeup to want to be held in high esteem by somebody else. And the desire by itself is not wrong. It's not wrong to want to be loved. What's wrong is when we don't want to be loving, we just want to be loved. But having said that, when we look at the word group as it's used in the New Testament, the essence of exulting is a feeling that a person gets when a person's goals are emphatically realized, particularly in the face of opposition. And that's why I use the sports metaphor. When you go into a sports arena thing and there are two teams competing with one another or two individuals or whatever, and you've chosen to cast your emotional well-being in the lot of one of those two, and the two are well-matched, and there's a pretty good opposition to the desire, when your team actually does win, you have this whoopee feeling. It's a feeling. And I think all of us recognize that. The accomplishment of a goal in the face of significant opposition, you won. And the goals diminished a great deal if the competition was no good. I mean, we were given tickets one time to go watch the Nebraska Cornhuskers play football in the arena there in Omaha, or Lincoln. It's in Lincoln, isn't it? And we went to the game. It was an opening game, home game, and you know, there's thousands of these red shirts. You don't know, almost don't dare walk in the stadium without a red shirt on. But anyway, the team they were playing the team was not rated. They didn't have much skill. It was a blowout. We were glad our team won, but it wasn't nearly like when you have a championship type of competition, there's real opposition here and you win. That's that exulting. That's what Paul's talking about in verse 4. Exulting. So what we're really dealing with is this desire for this feeling. And when we stop and think about it, what we're really talking about is the core issue of joy. Bottom line, that's what everybody wants all the time. Regardless of the setting, we want the joy of life. We've said many, many, many times that the essence of the promise is life, the essence of the life is joy, but we've never said what the essence of the joy is. It's exulting. It's that feeling of intense joy. It's more than just joy. It's that feeling of, you know, that gets you up off the seat and makes you pump your fist. That's the essence of the joy
that is the essence of the life, which is the essence of the Brahman.
So we just keep working our way into these things called essence issues. So what it boils down to is that Paul is talking about people in verse 4 who want to have a high level of joy in their experience. And according to verse 3, they're tempted to try to get that by thinking that they can accomplish it themselves, that think they're something, being nothing. And in verse 4, the implication is that they think they can get it by comparing their works to somebody else's works and seeing theirs as superior to those that other person's, and therefore they have this reason for being superior, and that translates into this sense of exalting. I'm not sure exactly how that works, except that it's along the lines of the pride of life, the temptation that was given in the garden. But nonetheless, that's what he's driving at, and that means that Paul is still dealing with the basic issue in Galatians. Because the suggested means in verse 4 is you can get this exalting by doing some work or some works and comparing them to a standard. And if they meet the standard, you can have this exalting. That's what he means. Let one, each one, examine his own works. Well, what does examine your works mean? Now, how do you examine your works? Well, you take something you've done, and then you say, okay, I'm going to examine this. I'm going to see if I can get any joy out of having done this. And you say, well, how do I examine it? Well, the word means put it to the test of a standard. Set it up against a standard and see if it'll meet the test. And he says, do that with your works. Well, what is the standard? What are you going to put it up against to see if it's legitimate? It's either going to be some instruction that God has given or some example that he's given where a certain kind of behavior is described and it's the standard is right here and your work meets or exceeds that standard. Then you can have exulting or joy, the high joy of life, rooted in what you've done. That's the suggested means to the end. Put your own works up against the standard, see if they meet the criteria. If they do, then you can exult. But in the text, what are the people doing? What's the standard in verse 4? Somebody else's works. You compare your works to their works. And if yours are superior, then you can exult. That's the temptation. And Paul says, don't yield to that. Don't go there. That is not the standard. If the only way we can feel good about ourselves is when we are superior to somebody else because we compare what they've done and what we've done, then Paul says, you're insane. That's not going to carry it. It will not bring you to exalting. It'll just give you a sense of arrogance and pride. No real exalting. So, what are we supposed to compare it to if it's not somebody else's works? Well, the fundamental criteria is always going to be the glory of the Father. The glory of God comes to the table. It says, this is what God is like, and therefore any works that are going to be bringing joy are going to have to match this. Well, who can match the glory of God? And that raises another question. Is Paul serious in verse 4? Does he really mean that you can get to the high joy of life by examining your own works? Can he mean that, given all of chapters 1 through 5? Is it possible for a person to ever do anything that he can say, this makes me feel really great in the face of God's glory because I've done this thing? Can you ever do that? Look over at 2 Corinthians just briefly. I realize we're getting out of our context in Galatians, but 2 Corinthians 10.
10 verse 12?
Yeah.
What does that say? We are not bold to class or compare ourselves with some of those who commend themselves, but when they measure themselves by themselves and compare themselves among themselves, they are without understanding. Which is basically what he's telling them not to do in Galatians 6. Do not compare yourself to somebody else. He says that is done by people who are dumber than stumps. They don't have any understanding. He said we don't compare ourselves with those who commend themselves because they measure themselves by themselves and compare themselves with themselves. In other words, they're just comparing themselves with each other and they're exalting themselves based on what they come up with. That was Paul's whole lifestyle, according to Galatians chapter 1, before he became a Christian. He was trying to be the best Pharisee in his generation. He was trying to be more zealous, more committed, and all that kind of stuff. Why? Because he wanted to be able to exalt. He wanted this joy of life, but he didn't have it because he wasn't a believer. And joy comes from being rightly related with author of joy. So, when you don't have the joy, you look for it. And the method, the typical method is compare yourself with other people and, you know, be sure that they are inferior to your ability so that you can feel good after you've compared yourself to them. Because if you compare yourself with somebody who's better than you are, you're going to come away feeling kind of like you have low self-esteem. So the criteria of comparing yourself with somebody else is just simply not legitimate. You have to compare yourself to God. And that raises the question that I raised. Is Paul serious? In the first place, how do you examine your own work by putting it up against the standard of the glory of God? How do you do that? I mean, how can we ever, any of us, say this work would meet the standard? Because what we're basically saying is, I have achieved perfection in this action. Can you ever say that? Look at 1 Corinthians 4. Look at what he says there in addressing our question. Paul says in verse 3 of chapter 4 of 1 Corinthians, it is a very small thing that I should be examined by you or by any human court. In fact, I don't even examine myself. Why? Verse 4. I'm conscious of nothing against myself, but I'm not by that acquitted. In other words, I may not be aware of any imperfection in my behavior, but that doesn't mean there's not any. And what's the outcome? The one who is going to do the examining is the Lord. And until he does the examining, I really can't. I don't care if you judge me. I don't care if a human court judges me. I don't even accept my own judgment about me. Because none of these kinds of judges have the kind of insight that the Lord has, and he's the only one who can do that. So given the fact that Paul says that, we have to ask ourselves in Galatians 6:4 if he's serious. Are we really supposed to take our works and examine them and seek for this sense of exulting from that? Are we supposed to do that, or is he simply pushing the envelope of verse 3? You want to go this route? You want to make yourself feel good about what you're accomplishing? Well, be sure that in the process you don't compare yourself to any other person. Just examine your own work. Personally, I don't think you can. I don't think it's possible for any of us to ever say, I am absolutely sure this will be accepted by God as a perfect work. And given that, where's my exulting? How am I ever going to get to exulting on the basis of something that I do if I can't ever put it up against the standard and come away confident that it's past muster? Well, the fact is, you can't. The fact is, when we try that, we come away depressed because our works don't measure up more times than we think they do. Even when we think we've done a good job, we have all these questions about, did I really do that right, and so on, so on, so on. So verse 4, I believe, is Paul just setting forth a practice if you're going to be the insane person of verse 3. If you're going to try to make yourself something out of what, by means of what you do, then at least restrict yourself to what you're doing and not somebody else. So, notice what he's doing if, in fact, verse 4 is an outworking of verse 3's insanity. What is he trying to do? He's trying to get his readers to do what he told them to do in verse 1, to be careful about their attitude when they're trying to restore a fallen brother or sister. And the attitude is an attitude of thinking that you wouldn't have done that if you'd have been in their shoes. He says, watch that, because the fact is, given the right kind of pressure and the right kind of situation, you will do anything to preserve yourself unless you're one of the spiritual. And that is, unless you're drawing your life from Jesus and the Spirit of Jesus dwelling in your body is protecting you from the temptation of thinking that you're something when you're nothing. If that's the case, then you won't be drawn into this, but if that's not the case, you will be, because this desire to exalt, to have this high, enthusiastic joy is a universal human desire. And we will try to find it somewhere. So, where are we going to find it? Well, Paul said in verse 1 of chapter 6 that if a person is caught in a trespass, you who are spiritual are supposed to take on this responsibility of bearing your brother's burden. Well, who are the people who are spiritual? Well, Galatians chapter 5, verse 22 and 23. And you remember that study, I hope, at least parts of it. The fruit of the Spirit starts. They're broken down into three groupings: love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, kindness, faith, meekness, and self-control. The first three, I told you, is not love for other people. It's not joy for other people. It's not peace for other people. These are the things you get by walking by the Spirit. What does it mean to get love by walking by the Spirit? It means that you become convinced that God loves you. You're one of the beloved. If the fruit of the Spirit is God's convicting work in you that He loves you, well, then what's going to happen? Joy. Peace. Because you're one of the beloved. So, those that are spiritual already know that they're getting their joy from being highly valued by the only person whose value means anything in this universe, and that is God. That's why he can tell the Corinthians, it's a small thing if you guys enter into some kind of judgment against me. What you decide doesn't mean anything to me. I don't care. Because I don't even care about my own judgments about myself. The only thing I care about is what God says about me. And if that's true, if it's really true, then to have God say to you, you are one of my beloved. I have laid down my son's life for you. I love you. You can't get more important than that, then you ought to have the joy of life in you. And if you don't, it's because you don't believe it. Oh, God couldn't feel like that about me. But he does. Said he did. So, his objective is to block the relationally destructive attitude of personal superiority. That's verse 1 at the end. That's verse 3. That's verse 4. He wants to block that. But his method has more than one part to it. On the one hand, verse 1 says that the accomplishment of the restoration that is supposed to produce some kind of joy stuff is rooted in whether you're spiritual or not, with extreme caution. Those who are spiritual, watching yourself lest you be tempted. And then he insists in verse 2 on a genuine attitude of desiring to be helpful. Restore the one because he needs the help. Don't restore the one because of some benefit you're going to get if he's restored. Restore the one because his burden's too heavy. You need to get under the burden with him. That's a legitimate attitude, genuine desire to be helpful. And then he plainly says, when it comes right down to The ability to do,
verse 1,
you who are spiritual. Well, who are they? They're the people that the Spirit of Jesus is working in, producing through. What's that mean? It means you're not doing it. He is. If we could just get past the idea that we're worthless because we can't do anything significant, or we're valuable because we can do something significant. If we could just get past that, that's all legalism, and get to the real core. Am I valuable or not? And who am I valuable to? That's the real core. In verse 4, he actually pushes the thing and says, look, if you're going to do it on the basis of works, do it on the basis of your own. Don't bring your brother into this mix at all. Just evaluate your own works. But what's the final impact of that? Look over at chapter 6, verse 14 that I've already pointed out. He says, may it never be that I should boast except in the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ. That's our basis for exalting. Never our own performance. The real bottom line is that the value that you have in the eyes of others, the actual root of the feeling of exalting, because you have this value in the eyes of others, is never realized by what you do for them. It is realized by what they will do for you. Did you understand what I'm saying? The value that you have in the eyes of others is never rooted in what you will do for them. Because if their value on you is based on what you do for them, then they don't really value you. They just value what they get out of you. The real value that you have in the eyes of others is measured by what they'll do for you. That's why the Bible says that the love of God is made manifest by this, that He sent His Son to die for us while we were sinners. That's what God would do for us. And because the Bible says He did that for us, we're supposed to conclude that He loves us. That's real value. We are really valuable to the people who will sacrifice for us without our requiring it or asking it or even expecting it. That's real value. We have no value in the eyes of people who only want us around because of what they get out of us. That's not value. So, what Paul is doing in verses 3 and 4 is hammering this notion that we should try to get anything out of what we do in terms of this sense of the joy of life. It's not what you do. It's what He's done. It's what He does. We can exalt in what God does for us because it proves His attitude toward us. Gracious and loving. We can't exalt in what we do for Him or others because the doing may be seriously flawed, may not be worth producing any joy. And we don't have the criteria or the basis for evaluating to find out if that's the case or not. So, the issue then in verse 4 is that Paul is setting forth a method that is basically a pursuit of verse 3 and the temptation of verse 1. If you're going to go down the works path, then at least restrict yourself to your own. That's the issue. And Paul has written this whole letter to try to get us to not go there. The joy that we're going to have for all eternity is going to be rooted in the cross of Christ. That's what Paul said, verse 14. Because this person died in my place for my sin, I will have his joy in my heart forever. Comments or observations or whatever, this is a short lesson tonight.